It's Wednesday, February 7th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 38 of Fear the Booth, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 3 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Booth. My name is Dan, and on the mics with me today is Mike.
Hello.
Adam.
Hi.
And Chad.
Howdy.
So look at that. You guys just don't know which way I'm going to introduce you. Could be on the left, could be on the right.
If this weren't take four, I would know.
Actually, you should know because it is take four, but you don't because I keep changing it up on all the takes.
Craziness.
All right, let's get down to it. First of all, a couple issues of business. I got a voicemail from a girl named Katie who wanted to show me some art. Unfortunately, Katie, in your voicemail...
Some naughty pictures.
No, that'd be perfect.
Come on, Adam at feartheboot.com. Why are you sending the good stuff to Dan?
Look, I'm having him send all the furry porn to you.
Yes, I know. I'm not appreciative.
See, and that's the problem. That's why you don't get to move up to anything else.
You're not appreciative that you don't. You just don't get enough.
I had to start a second Gmail account.
When this show kicked off, I had to work through the furry porn. I've now moved up to the human stuff. You're going to have to take your licks and get up there, too.
I'm not taking any sort of licks. This subject is gross. Let's move on.
All right, Katie, unfortunately, in your voicemail, I could not understand your email address. And since it's an automatic voicemail service, I also don't have your return phone number. So I have no way of getting in
contact
with
you. Which would
be really
creepy in and of itself, because she'd be sitting there and get a phone call like, "Hi, this is Dan from Fear the Boot."
With his radio bedroom voice.
My bedroom voice, according.
Kind of like a phone message I got from someone about snakes on a plane.
That was brilliant.
That was brilliant.
Yeah, I completely hated that Snakes on a Plane movie, but they had that whole marketing campaign. You could go to a website and fill out some different choices, and then it would custom tailor a message from... His name?
Samuel L. Jackson,
who would then call you up and actually even call you by name. And
it was pretty crazy.
It was creepy.
I was like, what the hell? Because Dan sent me one, and I was like, what the hell?
I sent one to Adam.
Is this Adam?
This is Samuel L. Jackson. Those things.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the great one about Adam was, for those of you who follow the show, partway through, you can pick who is sending the message, and I changed his to say, "Adam, get your girlfriend Melissa. Hop in the car and come on out to see my movie."
I was like, whoa.
And so then there's this...
And Adam had an ex-girlfriend named Melissa.
Who Melina's rather jealous of. And so then Melina wanted this big detective thing, trying to figure out why Melissa was sending messages from Samuel.
We kept that going all day. That was comedy gold right there.
That's because none of you had to go home.
That's right.
That's why it's comedy gold. So, Katie, I cannot understand your email address. So if you get a chance, please go to feartheboot.com, hop on the contact page, send me an email. I'd be happy to check out whatever it is you got. It's just unfortunately...
He doesn't know how to spell at .com.
You know, this is Dan we're talking about. This isn't one of those I'll call you in the morning things. He really does want to get in contact with you.
You know what's funny, though, is you really... That's, what you're saying there isn't too far from it. It sounded like three letters at once. And I'm guessing something about the call got... Like the wave got compressed or something was being processed, but... Next point of business, Tony on our forums, and Tony is also the...
Hi, Tony.
One of the hosts of the Fanboy Smackdown podcast, which is a movie podcast that we've done a crossover episode with. Tony is running a writer's critique group on our forum where you can post some amount of short fiction and then have the people on there give you some constructive feedback and help you out. He's also involved in a St. Louis writers group. And so he knows what he's doing with this stuff. It's a pretty cool group. If anyone out there is not on our forums, but you're interested in joining it, you need to hop aboard our forums and send a private message to Tony, just regular spelling of the name, and tell him that you want to get involved, and he'll have to give you access to that group. Two other quick things of business, both website related, and then we can get into the meat and potatoes of this episode.
Wait,
we're talking about something today?
Yeah, we are.
No, but, it's an hour and a half of business.
But getting past this business is a Herculean effort.
Oh, you used it.
That's nice.
Outrageous.
You can't tell him to use it, and then right after he uses it, you're like, oh, you used it.
That was an Olympian effort, Dan.
For the show is going the way of the Titanic.
All right, if you go to feartheboot.com, we have two new things up there that may be of interest to you guys. The first, if you look across that top line of menu items, we have a banners page now. A couple people have said to us, hey, I'd love to put up a banner or a chiclet or something for you guys but I don't have anything to use. So we created a banners page where you can get that stuff. The second thing is, if you look along that same menu bar, we also have a store link up there. We have finally released a fully featured Fear the Boot store, complete with all kinds of shirts and mugs and beer steins and all kinds of stuff. And if you go out there, we have pretty good control over what appears there. So if there's a product you'd love to see that you just don't see up there, like, hey, I'd like this logo, but could you guys put it on a hoodie or something instead of a shirt, just send me an email and let me know. We, like I said, we have pretty good control over that.
Yeah, thing. People are asking us for on the forums for a golf shirt. We're trying to figure out now, like, how we're asking them, where do you want the logo on it? What color do you guys want it to be? And then when we get a consensus on that, we're going to put it up.
Now, John is not with us tonight because he is out on a hot date.
I hope he scores.
But do you think he will?
No. Have you seen him? That's the face you want to look at, but has, not naked.
Has John Grana done it proper with the ladies?
But you have looked at it. Isn't there a story about Melina spanking him in his underwear?
My God, I was there for that.
But I wasn't naked. That's the difference.
It was a strip poker game at the end of a party, and it was like one of those, it wasn't like everyone's so drunk and they're acting stupid. It was more like they're sobering up and everyone was realizing how stupid they're acting. Well, there's John G, and Melina basically puts this bet on the table, and John counters the bet. It's like, okay, if you lose, you have to spank me in my underwear. And Melina's like, again, sober, kind of. She's drunk enough to do something stupid, yet sober enough to realize she's doing it. And, of course, she loses the bet, and this look on her face. There's John G in these tidy whiteys wiggling this little non-ass in her face. And she's just like, ew. She's got this scrunched up face. She's looking away and she's just this, he doesn't want to touch it, doesn't want to touch it. And then she just kind of like taps it and just like, oh, it's terrible.
There's not room enough for two gamblers in my relationship.
No.
Woman doesn't know how to play.
But before John went out on this hot date, he left us with a topic that he wanted us to discuss. It actually involves the girl that he is on a date with right now. He was telling me that he's gotten this new gaming group started up there at his college. This girl's a member of it. And some new people came in to this group.
Not just new people to the group, but people who have never played a role-playing game before in their lives.
And this girl immediately starts trying to push the healer off on one of them.
We've all been there.
What came to my mind upon hearing this, why is it that all gamers reach, like within their first couple sittings of a game, very similar conclusions? One of them is that nobody wants to play the healer, which is...
like gamer universals?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
What were some others?
Some of the other ones he was telling me was everyone's like, charisma? That sounds like a worthless stat. I'm going to put that as a 2 so I can put points in everything else.
Well, it is. It doesn't help you in combat.
It's easy. People want to play role-playing game stuff they can't do in real life. People don't care if their teeth are all shiny and they're making good impressions on
people. But most of these people are ugly in real life, so I don't know that this logic carries over.
I can't argue with logic of this magnitude.
They want to cast big fireballs that rock the earth around them. They want to lift buses off of people. They don't care about making a good first impression and healing my friend, you know.
Well, see, but this assumes that all of role-playing primarily comes down to, at least at first, a power fantasy.
Maybe not. Maybe they want to play a weird character that they, you know, they want to play some deranged crazy guy that they're not in real life.
Well, I think that when people are trying to, like when they very, very first come to a game and are introduced to the topic, generally speaking, the most of their experience comes from a stat sheet. Even if it's a high role-playing game, you're still making a character, and you're still going over the stats. So I think there's a certain degree of min-maxing that a person does. They're getting around that concept that a role-playing game isn't a competition, and you're not trying to win, and you don't really lose, and it's not a competitive game. So you're looking at these stats, you're looking at these numbers, and you want the best for you. So what is a character sheet except 90% of it is combat. 90% of it is rules that get out combat, and what does charisma do for you in combat? Except in very, very specific, minimal situations that a new player isn't even going to think up. A new person looks at a character sheet and is like, okay, I got to make this the best character I can, or the most powerful character I can, so I'm going to make it as combat-oriented as possible.
I don't know if I agree with this. I think that analysis is a little too in-depth for somebody who's flipping through the book for the first time. I think it comes from poor fantasy stereotypes. Think of Lord of the Rings.
Who I was the heal- that.
Who was the healer in the party?
That's true.
There wasn't one.
There was the Elf Ranger, which is one of those principal... Everybody plays an Elf Ranger at least once in their life. Or Aragorn. Or Gimli.
Well, Excalibur. Where's the cleric in Excalibur?
So you think that's what the problem is, that in popular fantasy, finding the healer is like finding the black guy on a hockey team?
Yes. Or the Abercrombie and Fitch ad.
Oh, my.
See, but what gets me about this is not the fact that these bad conclusions are reached, but the fact that it seems like the vast majority of gamers walking into the hobby start off with these. And, you know, it could be because of the stereotypes that existing fantasy creates. I've also got to think that, Chad, you kind of hit on it a second there, that maybe they're bringing the experiences of other games into this, that you walk in with the idea that this is a competition,
right.
This is a board game, maybe even this is a video game where killing is the objective,
mm-hmm.
and therefore you begin with this assumption that you need a high strength, high dex, low charisma, and that's the right. way to go.
Don't you?
Don't need intelligence. Or wisdom.
Personally, I don't even think you need a character sheet, but that's just me.
When I was reading up a little bit on MMO creation, kind of things that go into this, and I can't remember what MMO this was for. I want to say it was for Star Wars Galaxies, as sad as that is. They were talking about how they have identified that there are distinct styles of play. And they were, of course, talking about these online, massively multiplayer games. But I think that this is probably true of gaming in general,
mm-hmm.
and that they've identified that there are certain roles that people enjoy putting themselves into, at least within the context of these combat situations. And one of the roles that they identified is healing, which is something that I perfectly understand, because when I play an MMO, there are two roles I like to play, and healing is one of them. And I've known other people where that's what they always play in every game. They love to roll up the healer. And taking this back to a tabletop RPG, I guess what's kind of interesting is that you can have someone pick up an MMO for the first time in their lives, and they may instantly put themselves into a role that has nothing to do with doing damage. And once again, I know this because my very first MMO, the very first character that I ever created, was a relatively powerless healer. And it's just odd that this does not carry over into tabletop gaming.
Not at all. I play healers in MMOs all the time, but I don't like to play healers in tabletop games much.
But see, why is that?
In tabletop games, it's too much imagination, you know? There's story going on. You want to get involved in the story. Healers, stay back, heal your friends. They're not at the fore. They're kind of back line. I don't know.
Well, but you can say the same thing about the wizard.
But the wizard projects the power forward.
The wizard has interesting things that he's doing. You know, the cleric doesn't really have that much interesting to do.
See, this is why I don't like the whole level thing, the whole you're defined by your job thing. It's like whether you're playing a healer or not, or the fighter or not, I don't like the idea of you're playing a fighter. You're playing a healer. You are playing a person who is rich and deep and has a great background and a story and a personality who also has some healing spells.
You mean healers aren't all the same?
Yeah. We used to have a joke where first edition, I think it was, your character class was your character. You were Phytor. You could play... Elf was a character class. Your name was Phytor and Cleric and Ranger. And I don't know. I see that a lot in D&D. I see that a lot in people's D&D games where they are and I see this a lot in just class games. You are the class first, and then whatever personality and history you develop second. And I have always hated that.
I see that in MMOs, too, especially in kids.
In MMOs, I see that. I don't have a problem with it because an MMO is an automated dungeon crawl. At least all the ones are now. And it's very, very difficult to role play in them, if not impossible. And I admit, my MMO experience is limited. I've only ever played World of Warcraft. But
no, it's hard to role play in any of them.
Yeah, thus I've talked to people.
But yeah, I've not met a single MMO yet, except for John's.
Yeah.
Raving tales of, what did he play?
He plays on an
Ultima Online.
Well, and he also plays an online MUD, too, that he plays.
Well, MUDs and MUDs.
MUDs is designed
completely different animal.
Exactly.
Completely different animal.
Exactly. In fact, we were on a Shadowrun one.
Yeah, where there was lots of role-playing. Excellent role-playing.
And terrible role-playing,
and too. Terrible role-playing, but, you know, I think that's because it takes the fighting out of the way.
Yeah.
Because when you walk into these games, yeah, there was some element of combat, but, I mean, you could be on there for weeks, months, without ever having a single moment of conflict. And so it focused on that. Whereas, I mean, let's be honest, whether you're talking about World of Warcraft or EverQuest or any of these other games.
It's an automated dungeon crawl.
Yeah, within 30 seconds of appearing in the world, you've killed something.
Yeah.
And that pretty much will define your career from beginning to end. The world simply does not enable or encourage any kind of role play.
And you know what's weird, too, is that the quests that you get, the really cool ones, the interesting ones, the ones that people talk about in a positive light, are the ones where you don't do any combat.
Well, I will give EVE Online this. Sir. They're not combat-oriented. It's all about the trading, which I do like because it's at least a variation from the regular bat-whacking that you do in most games.
Well, my
EVE Online doesn't have enough depth.
Yeah, my problem with EVE Online is that I think it's a great thing and a terrible thing. Its number one strength is that it captures the loneliness and vastness and emptiness of space. Its greatest weakness is that it captures the loneliness, emptiness, and vastness of space.
Yeah.
I love it. It looks so great, and it has that great trading thing. But I feel like I'm all alone. As far as a trading thing goes, I can go to virtual stock exchange games and play on the market with fake money. You know, that would be more interesting to me. Even though in World of Warcraft, I am wheeling and dealing.
Let me carry that into another subject. There's a guy by the name of Jesse that listens to the show, who actually I know outside of the show and have known before the show, who is doing some kind of small studio video game development. He is a programmer, and he's mostly trying to do a CRPG sort of thing, like Fallout or Ultima or Neverwinter Nights, I guess. So not an MMO. And he was asking me, what is it that we as tabletop role players would need to see in a video game to make it enjoyable to sort of that same side of us that gets entertained by a tabletop role playing game?
Heavy characters, heavy plot, heavy setting.
Explain those. That's far from simple.
Also,
what
are you
really
talking
mean?
About like a role, like a single player role playing game, or are you talking about a Neverwinter Nights that doesn't suck?
Well, you know, and see, here's where one of my first thoughts came in, because when we've talked about what it is we enjoy about role playing games versus video games, where we're not trying to align the two, but we're trying to juxtapose the two, one of the first things that I always think of is the social element.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I was to carry that role playing element over to a CRPG, one of the first things I would be loath to let go of is the multiplayer aspect. In fact, I have always been kind of disappointed, and I realize this is very complicated, but I've always been disappointed that no one has ever taken on a story-based but cooperative game.
Yeah, like
boo cooperative.
Like being able to play Oblivion multiplayer. And
that'd,
not,
that'd be cool.
Not oh, well, we meet in the arena and we just beat each other. No, it's like instead of sitting down as a single person, you sat down as a party.
Here's
oh,
the
man.
Problem with that, though.
Two-man thief teams?
Ooh. In Oblivion, you're closing Oblivion gates. You're finding the air. If you did this in an MMO cooperatively, if Chad finds the air and Adam shuts an Oblivion gate and Dan shuts an Oblivion gate, what's left for me to do?
No.
You're either going to have to come up
well,
with...
Well, the idea is that we do this together.
You have to engineer the game so it would... It, be able to handle
well,
more than one person.
Let me split
things.
This in half.
I would
first
still
of all,
like to play multiplayer Oblivion.
You said in an MMO. We're not talking about an MMO, okay? We're not talking about thousands of people playing this. We're talking 2, 3, 4. All right, we're talking, you know, and the game that I can think of off the top of my head that came the closest to this was Baldur's Gate. You could play Baldur's Gate cooperatively.
Gate.
That would be cool.
Now, there were some limits to it because you had a limit in some ways. But I think their limits, I mean, went fairly ham-fisted. It's been a long time since I've played it, but there were things like I think only the party leader could make plot decisions and
stuff. Yeah,
such.
He was the only one who could talk to people who were important. I think he was the only one who could shop, too, and you had to buy the stuff and then disperse it amongst the people because he had all the money.
Yeah, I don't remember. So
it was very poorly designed and hard to do, almost to the point that it wasn't worth it.
But you need heavy setting, heavy characters. Now, with characters, the problem there would be...
Well, let's break those out. Heavy setting. What gives heavy setting? What does that really mean?
I think Oblivion does a fairly good job in that places look different. You can see the grass. I mean, everything's very vivid.
And there's an internal consistency to the world. If you've ever played any of the other Elder Scroll games, like I'm playing through Morrowind right now, and I played Oblivion. I had never played any of the other games, and I was just amazed. I'm like, this is the same world. And not, it's the same thing over again. Oh, I'm playing in New York and whatever. No, the feel of the world, the internal consistencies, the everything about it. And it doesn't even take place in the same areas as Oblivion. Oblivion makes references not to the game, the previous games. It makes references culturally. And the culture holds true over the world.
Fallout,
it's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something else I think is missing from a lot of these games, and this kind of falls into setting, is I really don't feel like I'm a part of the setting in most of them. And this is something that some games have allowed a little bit of, but not much. Owning property, opening shops, mm-hmm. having something where I feel like I existed before the story, and I feel like I exist apart from the story.
And that your purpose in the story isn't to kill the main bad guy that killed your mother in Act 1. Like,
yeah.
You actually live there. I'd hate to keep on bringing up Oblivion, but Oblivion does a really good job of this, where it's like, the king is like, okay, there's the plot, go, and I'm going to die, and there's the plot. And you're just like, yeah, I want to go over there. I'm going to go over here and
I'll take
join
Oblivion
the
in a different angle there, where you just materialize in a cell.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's never explained why you are in this cell. In the cell.
They had to get you in there somewhere. But you know what? And I've never actually played this game. I've only talked to people who've played it. Fable takes the opposite tack on
that. That's true.
You start as a child. The Legend of Zelda games, which are not role-playing games. I hate it when people link Legend of Zelda with a role-playing game. It's not a role-playing game. It has role-playing elements in it, but it's a puzzle-solving game. I don't know about the Wii one. Twilight Princess might be different. I haven't played it yet. I really want to.
It's so good. I know.
No, it's still an adventure game, though.
Yeah, it's an adventure
sort
of puzzle game.
It's not a role-playing game.
But
great game, but no, it's not a role-playing game.
The most recent Legend of Zelda games, you start out, you're a boy, and you start out in a village, and you grow up like Ocarina of Time. You go back and forth using time travel between being a boy and being a man. There's another game, Grandia 1, not the horrible sequel, but Grandia 1. You start out as a boy, and you're in a neighborhood, and you're playing like knights in armor with the other boys, and you know you have your character sheet and stuff, and you put on armor. And it is
like an apron.
It's a stick and an apron and a pot for the helmet and stuff. And it kind of it's the trainer aspect of it.
So getting back to Oblivion, part of my problem there is they kind of went this direction with like the housing and such, but it's like it didn't go further than that. I still did not feel like I was a person. I could not open a business. I could not find a wife.
The closest you could do is you could get stock in a business if your mercantilism was high enough. But it still wasn't.
My understanding is that Fable does that. Fable, you can get a house and a wife and have a kid. I don't know if you can have kids, but, you know.
Well, hold on, because the Fable's not the subject at hand here. So, continuing this thought of what it would take to carry the tabletop role-playing experience into a video game. We just talked about
Eliminate setting
and immersion.
Eliminate the video, get people, and get books and dice, and sit around a table and play.
I agree with you that, to me, there is a certain something that tabletop role-playing captures that a video game, at least at the current level of technology, just plain cannot do.
And, you know, I don't want it to.
But
I love role-playing games and video games and stuff. I don't want to combine the two hobbies.
I look forward to the day when we can sit in a simulator and walk through campaigns in a simulator and stuff. I think that would
Are you
be
talking
awesome.
Like a holodeck?
Yeah.
Because that takes it to a level that's beyond.
Yeah.
I mean, that's totally
awesome.
Different.
I mean,
oh, of course. Yeah. Well, I mean, we talked about that the last episode. You know, you'd program something in, the doors would open, you wouldn't be wearing pants, and you'd walk right in.
Oh, yeah, we'd never leave.
I never wore pants.
Well, yeah.
Me and Worf are in a bat left fight to the death.
With no pants.
That's wise to the death. And what you guys have seen, one of you can't walk out.
If we both walked out with pants, one of us would be gay.
So, Mike, you said that, but though kind of, Chad, working within that sort of the limits of this question of theoretically, what are the kinds of things that we would like to take from the table into a video game? You said a heavy setting.
Heavy setting, characters, and plot.
All right. Plot's pretty obvious.
Oh, yeah. You have to have a good story with lots of weaves, lots of twists and turns, and lots of stories going on.
But let's talk about character. One of the things that Jesse mentioned is he said that I feel like in a lot of CRPGs, I really am nothing more than my stat sheet. And I think a big thing that comes from is the lack of setting, the lack of your context within the setting, like we just talked about. But is there something more to it than that you think?
Having hobbies and things to do outside of the main game. I mean, maybe you are a whittler. Maybe you like to play chess or something like that. I mean, playing chess inside a video game, these meta video games where you play video games within video games or whatever, get a little bunch of times.
No, I love them. Well, I love them. But, like in Star Wars,
Knights of the Old Republic.
Knights of the Old Republic. Here it comes. There was a game called Pizzazz.
Oh my god!
I stopped being a Jedi, and I started, and the game didn't allow this. Becoming a professional Pizzazz player. Everywhere I went, every person who would play it, I would play them until I ran that NPC out of money and they couldn't play me anymore.
Something else that bugs me.
Love that game.
Related to characters. And I realize that within the current technology, there would have to be finite choices. But I feel like when I walk into a video game, I can choose what I am in some games you can't even choose that. But I feel like I can never choose who I am.
Yeah.
That like, you know, with Oblivion, I have to start off as...
Well, you chose the character sheet. You didn't choose the personality.
Exactly. Well, it's not even... Personality is a big part of it. It's not just personality. It's even my history. When I play Oblivion, I have to be the prisoner.
Yeah.
What if I don't want to be a prisoner? What if I want to be the captain of the guard who's escorting the king out? What if I want to be the king? What if I want to be the guy who's up in the town who gets drug into this against his
The king gets... 30 seconds in.
Yeah, you don't want to be that king.
Well, but that's the point. If I was playing the king, you know, maybe I could make some different choice.
Well, to some extent, it's unavoidable because if they don't dictate at least some of your history, why would you even be in the game?
Because I could see...
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. I recognize there'd have to be finite choices.
No,
but
I think
when you start Oblivion, why couldn't there be like half a dozen things to choose from?
See, I think that they could give you that half a dozen list and then you'd be sitting here right now and you'd be going, there were only a dozen choices on this list. They need to make it to where I could be the baker and the town guy. And you know what? I would have to agree with you too, but computers don't work
well,
like
right,
that.
But once again, within the context of the specific question of with today's technology, what are the kinds of things that would help push it in that direction? That's one of the things I would throw out there.
That doesn't bother me so much because when I play a game like Oblivion or any of the others that we listed that really allow you to have choice in your actions, I don't mind starting out as the prisoner because I'm kind of starting out with this blank slate and it is my own actions that I have defined the personality that's going on in my head. And then after playing for a little while, that personality develops and then it starts coloring all the choices and actions that I make.
Well, and when I said lots of heavy characters, I meant partially the main character or you in the game, but I also meant NPCs. And actually, NPCs will also help you develop your character because in the games that are out there, the dialogue options just simply are very, very limited.
It's yes or no.
Sometimes NPCs boil down to two things. People you can kill or quest givers.
Or people you can sell stuff to.
Well, or I'd have a third one. Yeah, people you can kill, people give quests, vendors. And then the people where you walk up to them, they have one repeated line of dialogue.
Oh, Final Fantasy
stuff. Final Fantasy. Yeah. I'm going crazy.
Well, and sometimes they have little supplemental information about your quest or whatever. But yeah.
They have to go to class and they just stand there.
They're not. You walk up to them, they're non-people. Yeah, and you know, speaking about dialogue options, in addition to lacking a lot of variety in them, they also lack emotion.
Yeah.
That I almost wish when you talk to someone that, yeah, sometimes I realize you have to give logical choices of yes or no, but they'd allow you to do something to kind of spin the emotion you're giving this person. Are you being polite? Are you
being
hostile? That's
what Fable was supposed to be. Fable had this AI for the characters that nothing would be scripted and that their actions, decisions, even their personality would be dictated by the forces of the environment on them. And when I say environment, I just don't mean the weather. I mean like all the things in the environment, your actions, the other NPCs' actions bouncing off and back and forth between each other.
And ideally, it'd be so flexible and versatile that I could just type in exactly what I want to say, and the AI can understand.
Now we're diverging from the question, which is with today's technology.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I realize, the holodeck with a mother brain type AI is the ideal way to go.
Michelle Barrett as the AI.
But, listen, well, okay, if mother brain's around, that means my girl Samus is in town, and I am busy, boys.
You need a can opener.
Let's look at like Planescape Torment. That game had a lot of really good dialogue options. It had a lot of ways that you could kind of round out and make your character. I mean, you could make him who you wanted him to be because ultimately, the history and everything was set. But you could take the dialogue options in lots of different ways, and that's at least a good move that you can use with modern
technology.
How much
of that, though, is incumbent upon the player to develop their character in their mind, to make decisions in character based on the personality that they chose? I mean, ultimately, even if the game allows you to choose this personality and to be like this, when you're faced with an NPC, you're faced with a flow chart. How you follow that flow chart, I don't want the game dictating that for me.
You know, I think when you look at a role-playing game, if we're talking about the kind of role-playing that we play with stories and deep characters and all that.
Like killing, killing, killing.
99% of all of that is in our head.
Yeah.
I mean, there are no rules, mechanics, or personality. there are no rules, mechanics for personality. There's nothing on your character sheet that really strongly suggests any kind of a background. This is all in our head. I guess really the difference between the two is that what is in my head in a role-playing game, the world will react to. Whereas what is in my head in a video game, the world will not react to. That if I walk up to the guard and all my options are yes or no, he's like, did you do it or didn't you?
And you want to say, look at your beard.
Yeah, or even just yes or no with different emotions, or yes or no with different context or different purpose. The world's going to react to that, whereas in a video game, you just have the cold black and white text of yes and no.
And then even if you had all of that nuance, then you're looking at the guard is like, did you kill that man? And then you're faced with a list of 50 nuanced choices that boil down to
yes or no.
Right.
And it's like, you know what? I don't want that either. The whole point of playing a role-playing game for me, a role-playing game, video game, is that it conveys a great story that I can interact with, and everything is automated.
I guess, and you know, this is where I don't think there is a good mechanic I can point to that already exists, but where I'd love to see the innovation is right on that one point of in a role-playing game, a tabletop one, the world is aware of who I am, but in a video game it is not. That all these things about setting and all these things about story to me really comes down to I want a game that is aware of who I think my character is.
You should play Knights of the Old Republic. And I'm not saying it'll deliver 100% that what you're looking
for. Pazak will deliver 100%
of
every dream and desire you have ever had.
All right,
I don't think it delivered that.
It doesn't deliver it 100%, but I mean, you can be good and you can be evil and you can be in between. I mean, there's this whole level thing, but with Knights of the Old Republic,
Adam, I've got an important question for you.
Here comes Blitzball or Pazak.
If I had Blitzball and Pazak.
God, Blitzball sucks.
No, I think Blitzball over Pazak.
Blitzball's boring.
So no, Blitzball's awesome.
Swim, swim, swim. Pass. Swim, swim. It's water polo. It's
Pazak
like 3D
playing cards.
They're both retarded.
But it's good. Take strategy.
I love to gamble. Don't worry. Trust me, I love to gamble, so I love the card playing. But Pazak, Jackshot, come on.
That's all Blitzball is Jackshot. Jackshot win. Jackshot win.
Well, you have to earn the Jackshot.
Yeah, in the first 5 minutes.
No, it's half an hour in.
Yeah.
That right there will transition nicely into our gaming advice topic, which is the economy within your role-playing game.
You have to buy the Jackshot.
Yeah.
With time and love. Alright, so whereas we're working through now the harder subjects of the game design series, we've gotten into rules. The one that is up now is the economy. Now, with the economy, we're talking about this from a couple angles. We are talking about trade, itemization, money, everything that goes along with it. So we're going to work through this, but this is just a big bundle.
And we have 5 minutes to do it in.
We have more than that. This is a big bundle of related topics that are all about the stuff within your role-playing
game. All right, let's blaze through these. 1, 2, 3, let's go.
Nouns, not people, not places. Let's roll.
Let's talk about your first encounter with itemization, which is probably
bullet
during character creation.
To the head.
That's your last encounter with itemization. Your first encounter with itemization is during character creation.
Weapon, armor, ammo, ranged weapon.
No, that's not
rope,
even that's not even how modern
food.
Role-playing games do it. You have X amount of money. You are a 30-year-old man. You have X amount of money. Now buy your life. Cool.
Yeah. And you know what? This equipment list we're giving you is guns and armor and weapons, which is, you know, a given, and maybe 20 items that you can buy in a sporting goods store.
Yes.
And now you have to define your character's life through equipment. With just the selection.
That's too impersonal for me. I'm not creative enough to think of things that I picked up along the way or things that would make sense.
Well,
I have to go with another system.
Let me ask you guys this. I see two ways of approaching this, and this isn't really a game design thing. It's more of a play style thing. When you make a character, comes time to get equipment, do you want to say, well, he has this gun and this armor and these one or two things, and we're just going to assume he has changes of clothes and food and a backpack and rope and candles and chalk and all the other nice little D&D things? Or do you want nothing is assumed? When you define he has a car key, you have to define the key ring, each key on the ring, and each charm on the key. He has a cell phone. He has a cell phone holder. He has pocket lint. You know, maybe not going
that far. Here comes the divergence of the simulationists at this table, I think.
Well, I don't think so. I would just take this back to the chorus of the series. Go back to your field document. That if you take a game like D&D, which is primarily geared towards heroics, no, the sword you own, you need to understand in great detail who owned it before you and what it looks like and where it came from. But whether you're carrying changes of clothes or a portrait of your mom, or it really doesn't matter. You can just say you have whatever, and it doesn't really mean a damn thing in terms of game mechanic. Something like Skies of Glass, where it's a survivalist game. Yeah, I mean, those things really do matter.
Well, what's another game on the market that people know that it does matter?
Shadowrun, maybe, because in Shadowrun you actually have a lifestyle, and the lifestyle implies secondary possessions, and that lifestyle also does figure back into the game mechanic in terms of the kind of security you have, the environment you're trying to heal within if you're injured.
I think Vampire the Masquerade, depending on what the game master's doing.
Fingernail polish and stuff like that.
I don't know if you can base that on the game itself as opposed to what type of game. Because if it's heavy problem-solving sort of stuff, anything in your equipment could potentially be used.
Oh, yeah, if you're playing LucasArts Adventure Game, the role-playing game.
Oh, I know one. That actually reminds me. Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
You're going to need every single paper clip, piece of string, Rubik's Cube.
All right, I guess I'll revise my position on this then.
It's a comedy game, but another one's Paranoia.
Yeah, Paranoia. You need to mark down everything.
The couple times I played Paranoia, at least in the games I was in, I went to the ends of my equipment list, and it was not a very long equipment list. I wish it was longer, and I went to the ends of it.
Well, let me put to you this way. It matters in Paranoia if you have a red pin or a green pin.
Well, yeah, exactly, within that comedy element.
Yeah.
So I think it really depends on the feel of the game, whether you need to indicate these things, but indeed as the game designer, when you are writing up those equipment lists for people to shop from, or even just writing the plain text blocks around it, urging them on what the kinds of things they should write down, you just got to understand the sort of experience that your game is meant to convey. Something else that comes right into this is money.
Money. I like money. Go ahead.
Well,
let's
begin with the way that money is exchanged in the game. Before we get to other stranger topics related to money.
You mean economy?
Sometimes I think it doesn't matter. World of Darkness, White Wolf. It's modern day. You have greenbacks, money. It's just a number on the sheet, and you buy things and stuff. Shadowrun.
Chris Pick.
Very, very important to know how you have your money, how the money is exchanged and stuff. Mm-hmm. Because it's part of the world. It's all electronic, and they have these devices, and the devices can be hacked. And
when your cred stick's tied to your sin, and if you don't have a sin, what do you do about creds, right?
You can get at least in some versions of the game, you could get unbound cred sticks and such. But it was a little used rule, but same thing exists within Battletech. They had the C-bill, which is, of course, the most common form of currency, but then you had various house bills and local scripts that they actually had conversion charts for, so that you could actually get paid in different currencies based on where you were. I don't know there's much point to doing it.
And it's just a depth thing.
Yeah, it's just a depth thing, but they did have it in there. So if you wanted to add that little element of roleplay, you could do that.
D&D, it matters. I have 1,000 gold coins. Well, I have a weapon and I need a mule to carry it. Bludgeon somebody with my money.
I was wondering about demand and availability, you know, because in certain like in D&D, for example, in some areas like Red Steel, it's a crappy campaign setting, but steel is very hard to come by, so that the currency is actually steel, because you would not go into a store and buy, you know, steel armor. Whereas if you're playing in Forgotten Realms or Dragonlance or something like that, Forgotten Realms anyway, steel would be, you know, you buy swords out of it. It's not a currency. It's pretty abundantly available.
Availability actually figures in a couple levels, one of which is going to be feel, like you said, that steel armor should be hard to come by in Red Steel, for example.
And price.
The other is balance. that within a game, there may be extremely rare items. Because they are powerful, they are therefore also supposed to be extremely hard to come by. And if that's not something that the game master and players keep in mind, then that right there can also erode both feel and balance of the game all at once.
And status, too. If you're in Red Steel wearing a set of steel armor, that would really say something about you.
Yeah, I can actually even think of times in both video games and role-playing games where poorly enforced availability actually somewhat damaged the feel of the game for me, because you're wandering along and you get what's supposed to be a really rare magic sword. I guess an MMO is not a good example, so I'm not talking about those. I'm talking like
Wombat drops magic sword.
Right. I'm talking about computer RPGs, like single-player CRPGs and tabletop games. I remember Tim ran a game, this was many years ago, where everybody was just rolling in magical items, and it got to the point that when you found any of these things or got anything, you didn't care. I mean, there was no sense of scarcity, no sense of achievement to getting it.
You didn't kill more monsters to get better loot.
Yeah, this just became kind of the garbage haul of the party.
Is it the game designer's responsibility to somehow limit the Monty Hall campaign?
Well,
Or even promote it?
Yeah, no, here's the thing that I would say. I think this is something you got to ask yourself. If that kind of scarcity is important to the feel of your game, once again, like feel or balance of your game, then I think it is incumbent upon the game designer to at least offer some kind of mechanic for understanding that. That you can say, well, this sword is really rare, but what does that exactly mean?
Right.
Like within MechWarrior 2nd Edition, I'm not sure if they did this in 1st or 3rd editions, so they don't own 1st or 3rd editions, but in 2nd Edition, next to each item, you had a tech level and an availability. Mm-hmm. And then you could actually take that back to a certain chart that said, look, if you're not a certain kind of character, you can't even find this stuff at character creation. And during the game, this group has a lot of it, this group has some of it, this group has barely any, and this group has none at all.
Yeah, I don't think it's the game designer's burden to eliminate and or force this kind of behavior. I think it's the game designer's, I don't know, almost requirement to enable it.
Well, I mean, Shadowrun has some of it, too, with the street index.
Yeah, the street index and availabilities and such, where you call your contact because you want them to buy you a machine gun. There's dice you shoot. There simply may be no machine gun on the black market to give you. Hmm. And I like that. In fact, I use that all the time when we would play Shadowrun.
But then conversely, there are games where, in Tim's campaign, where you all have magical items and those games happen and you can't just straight prohibit that kind of
stuff.
Right,
you know, yeah. That may be appropriate. There are sci-fi games that we've run, particularly, Mike, within the group that you and I were a part of, where you guys were military special ops, and everything was available to you.
Yeah,
if you wanted it, and that's the way it's supposed to be. I mean, they were going to give you the best that mankind had to offer because you were out there doing the duty for mankind as a whole.
Now, they wanted to challenge you, so they gave you, like, duct tape and a pocket knife.
There's one that I don't understand in computer role-playing games. The world's about to be destroyed. You're the only one that can save the world. Everybody knows you're the guy saving the world.
Yeah, everybody is so
2,000
Jill
for a potion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Diablo is a prime example. It drove me nuts.
Yeah, you want to save us all from being consumed by a horde demonic force?
And we know you're
25 grand.
Yeah. Save your own ass. By the way, for any listeners who are heavily into Red Steel, I think I might have gotten Red Steel and Dragonlance mixed up, but you get my point. I don't want to look like an idiot.
Too late.
Mike's an idiot. I actually think you are right. That is Red Steel, but I don't really remember. So,
or even care. Red Steel sounds awful.
Cut out the background. He needs to be more incendiary. Chop it up and say, screw you, listeners. You think I'm wrong. It was Red Steel. Eat my ass.
That's right. Red Steel's the new Shadowrun on my watch.
Speaking of availabilities, though, something else that, and this could potentially require a lot of paperwork, but nonetheless could be important to the game, is doing the availabilities by region.
Yes, especially in the game we're developing.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the game. If you're playing a game where there's supposed to be a lot of regional diversity, or you're trying to enable things like trade, then you have to define specifically what is common and what is rare in each place.
That's all going to come down to feel, though. I mean, in generic fantasy land, where every kingdom is the same and there's always a blue dragon and the dragon just changes color between kingdoms. Everything is the same, and it doesn't matter.
But that's what we're trying to get away from. That's the point of this
show. Well, yeah, no, I mean, within this series specifically, we're trying to help people design the game they want. And then after
and then in the other series, we advise people to stay away from those kinds of games.
We try to adjust what it is they want.
Ooh, saucy.
You also got to watch the itemization that you put within the game, because this can really push players in a certain direction. One of the things we pick on repeatedly is riffs.
Well, what about riffs?
I don't know. I was interrupted by the dance party around the mic.
We are clearly flexing.
Oh, okay. Why the hell are you flexing?
You paused when you were looking at that, and we had to entertain ourselves.
That's right. Otherwise, we'd just make Tourette's-like outbursts. So.
Well, at least your hands were
well, actually, you know what? Now we have to make Tourette's-like outbursts, because Tim White insinuated that I was afraid to speak during these episodes.
That's right.
Dan yeah. Because I have a Danecture.
Danecture?
I don't think... This has got to be... That's a word that can only be said right in some, like... Foul tongue.
I think only Scandinavians can say that word correctly.
And Tim White's not even Scandinavian.
I put two skill points in demonics.
Danter. Ouch.
You'd like six cursed tongues to...
So I've tried to talk this episode just to appease him.
And Tim appreciates that.
I bet he does. Everybody appreciates it when I talk.
But it was funny, though, what he was saying, that you guys were bashful to talk because I would cut off your mic in some kind of like Bill O'Reilly outburst. And I'm trying to picture you guys being that timid and me being that Bill O'Reilly.
Did you know they did that to Slobodan Milosevic before he died?
Did they really?
At his war crimes tribunal.
They cut off his mic?
Yeah, they had the mics and stuff and the cameras going, and they would...
Chad, shut up. You're ruining the show. Now...
Through the power now.
Monkey staff.
So yeah, what do? He would get up there and he would start making a political speech, and they'd ask him to stop, and he would just keep going on this political speech, and the guy would just mute his mic, and then he would just go on in silence, and then eventually they would carry on with court procedures and stuff, and eventually he would realize that no one was paying attention to him and the mic was muted, and then eventually he'd slow down and kind of stop, and they'd stop and sit down, then they'd unmute his mic and continue on.
Wow.
Politics is funny.
People with delusions of grandeur are funny. Anywho, getting back to this, one of the things that we pick on regularly is riffs in this regard. When you have a game where there is a player can start off with Glitter Boy armor or a pistol.
Or a pistol?
Exactly.
That's balanced.
Yeah.
This game is stupid.
Precisely. You are forcing somebody to play a certain kind of character. I mean, if you make these things not only accessible and possible, but also, I mean, you enable or encourage these things, you are forcing people to play a certain kind of character. Because even we, as much as we love story-based games and deep characters and blah, 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 the fact still is that most of these role-playing games do still involve some element of combat, and as long as they're still involving some element of combat, everybody wants to be at least generally competitive, and so nobody's going to want to be the guy where, okay, the Game Master created an enemy that challenges the Glitter Boy. What does the historian with the pistol do?
Well, I don't even have history.
I
don't even have a problem with there being an imbalance in combat, but like in your games that are, you know, big plot and big problem-solving, I don't mind somebody being good at combat if they're bad at something else, whereas another player picks up the slack, so long as everybody's good at something and is useful to the game.
Yeah, I guess that's an important point, that as you're looking at the game, you just have to consider possible itemization as another form of game balance against everything else in the game. The difference being, items can get better. If you create a guy who's got all the knowledge skills and all the contacts and all the attribute points, but has crappy equipment, no big deal. Two settings into the game, he goes out and gets the powered armor.
That's true.
And now all of a sudden the guy who sacrificed everything for that equipment has nothing because he cannot advance his character half as quickly as the other guy can pick up stuff.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah.
I don't ever see a power leveling game actually occurring that way where they sacrifice their equipment for the stat points.
It does happen in Shadowrun, for example.
Does it really?
Absolutely.
Do people actually play it that way, though?
Yeah.
Well, you can pick up your loot fast. I mean, in the game.
Yeah, in my understanding, though, like, if you want to play a mage or something, I think Chris Hussey was saying this. You know, if you want to play a mage, you have to sacrifice everything.
That's right.
And then, you know what? You sacrifice everything, right? And you get all these, a couple of magic powers, and then you go to an ATM, and you withdraw money from your account, and you buy the guns and armor.
You know something else that I'd like to see more of in a lot of role-playing games? This is just me personally.
What?
Is lists of costs on secondary
items. You
just
like lists.
I do love lists. You can just
numbered,
give me...
Numbered, ordered, whatever.
Great
just
big
give me a
spreadsheets.
List.
like, for example, I'll give D&D credit for this one. You can get prices on housing, boats, ox carts.
Well...
Yeah, the pricing's screwed up.
It's screwed up,
in
yeah.
In the housing, people come to kill you and you have to kill them. In the boats, you sail to kill people. In the ox carts, the ox pulls you to kill people.
Well, the ox, you know, you need somebody to haul the stuff after you kill the people and
the
take
the ox is
loot.
A level 1 critter and yields 250 experience.
Oh, he's dead.
Yeah, we came up with that conspiracy for D&D. We could, like, buy a bunch of chickens and kill them all to get XP.
Yeah. The easy way to level 2, man.
There you go.
You know something else that I've seen role-playing games...
You got all that food.
Yeah.
Something else that I've seen role-playing games starting to do more and more, which can be both good and bad, is MMO-style trade skills, where within the RPG you can get crafting skills, and then they have some kind of, here's a material cost, here's a workshop cost, here's the amount of time it takes to build it, and this is what you get out of it. And I personally like it. Because
really?
I think, yes, I think it gives you
It's
this,
a lot better than the, well, shoot two dice.
Well, the shoot two dice are even better than you can't make them. You have to go find a blacksmith who has these skills because you just don't for no particular reason. So I
Do they line it out more like what you can make? Is it more clearly defined than you take a blacksmith skill and you have 5 points in it, whatever that means?
Well, it's somewhere between the two. It's like, okay, looking at like Star Wars or D&D, both of the D20 editions, they have something there where it's like you take, I think it's like a certain percentage of the base cost, you convert it to a different kind of, like I think it's in D&D, you convert it to silver pieces. For example, within the D20 editions of Star Wars and D&D, I think you take like the base price of the item, convert it to some other unit of measure, and then that represents your hours of work, and then you shoot D20s, and that's going to determine how long it takes. And, you know, it's a little more involved. It's not quite a, you need the right tool and the right item, but it at least gives some definition to it, and you can get a feel for what your progress and success is. And I like that, because I think it adds a certain level of definition to the game. The only downside to that is, depending on how the game master runs the game, if
it
the
could
game,
suck.
Well, if the game's too fast-paced, you can never do it. If the game is too slow-paced, you abuse it. Because all of a sudden, I remember playing a Star Wars game where they took all these crafting skills. They couldn't afford any of the really good gear they wanted, so they just took all the right trade skills, emptied out their money, and then first thing in the game, they just camp out on their spaceship for the next, like, 2 months, building all these, like, custom-tooled blasters and war droids and all this other
stuff. I'm lightsaber man, and I throw lightsabers at you. There's 200 million lightsabers.
You make the lightsaber gun that shoots lightsabers.
You know, that'd be awesome. What you do, you just take a lightsaber, turn it upside down, and you just drop it in the ship, and then just leave.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be the tactic. Look, look, ship go away. Oop.
5 minutes later. 5 minutes later,
it's
going to turn inside out.
The bottom of the ship.
So I personally am a believer in those things. I guess one thing that comes down to feel, just does this kind of thing really make any sense in your role-playing game or not? If it does, I say put it in there because it gives you some other context in the world. So let's talk real quick about how we're handling this in Skies of Glass, because we have a couple strange things we're doing with it. Then we can get into today's Skies of Glass Q&A.
Ooh,
so,
I'm excited.
No. So,
you're going to the pier.
I love your movie.
So two things on the Skies of Glass economy. First of all, within Skies of Glass, because of the fact that we have broken the back of the human culture as a whole, money is now worthless.
Huh, you mean exchanging paper doesn't
well,
do
actually,
it for me anymore?
Considering it happened late in the 21st century, probably most of it was just electronic money.
Well, that's true.
Suddenly the disk space or whatever they use, the optical chips that's recording your bank account, just isn't that worth anything anymore.
The U.S. Mint doesn't print anymore. It's just a huge data center.
I could buy it.
Well, if you don't go that angle, I mean, even today here in the early 21st century, my bank account is stored electronically. I have very little paper money at all in my possession right now. So, and the economy goes down, not only is that paper money worthless, but on top of that, very few people have it. So, what instead becomes important is the goods off of which life is sustained. And for
like
that...
paperclips.
And
like
for
food.
For that, we have created a system that we are calling the barter value, or BV. And every item in the world, in each location, has an abstract BV. Okay, for example, in an apple orchard, an apple would have a low barter value because there's apples everywhere. So we would say it has a low BV. Whereas if you go to someplace out in the desert where nobody has apples and the king there really wants an apple, that same apple suddenly has a very high barter value.
Or unless you're the only apple orchard in town, then that BV is going way right up.
So one of the first things we're going to do is to enable that kind of trade and also to show the differences between locations. We are going to create a template barter value chart that we are going to copy over with the exact same items between every location that we do a micro setting entry for. So if you go to this one place, you will realize that here it's fairly easy to get a firearm, whereas over here it is not. The second thing we are doing is we are getting rid of any kind of a system of money in most places. And where we do have money, we will try to tie that money back to a barter value so you can convert it against the rest of the system. So you know, for example, this coin is worth 10 barter value and that apple is 50 barter value, then you know that apple costs roughly 5 coins in the city. Now, the barter value concept we're using is not something that people on the street would really quantify. For example, they may say colloquially that this blanket has a high BV or this blanket has a high barter value because they know they can get a lot for it. But no one has this quantified down to, well, in this city, this has a 20 BV. They would instead just know, in this town, I can get a lot for my blanket.
Abstract quantity.
In fact, the only reason we have those numbers in there is just so you can play the game. So you can quantify kind of in sort of a metagame mechanic that when you go to the old lady and you're trying to get dried meat off her and all you have to trade with her is a blanket, this is probably, in terms of dried meat, what that blanket is worth.
Or you could say that I have a bag full of trade goods, and I have 500 BV worth of stuff, and it's just a whole lot of individual stuff. Well, you don't want to write down 500 individual little items that you defined, and then when you go to the game master, like, do you want this? No. Do you want this? Yeah. No. Do you want this?
I need a pound of meat, and for this, I will give you 15 paper clips, 6 screws, 1 bumper off a Cadillac.
But of course, if you just have a bag of 500 BV in Nevada, the items that are in that bag are going to be worth very different amounts in Maine.
We could also quantify that out, too. We can like have a little chart where it's like you've been playing a while, you've acquired a lot of little stuff, and you could say, well, I have a whole bag full of stuff that isn't useful to me, but it can be traded. We can just roll on a chart, and it gives, you know, list to set. It's like, oh, you got 300 nuts and 4 screws and 15 paper clips.
Or even just pick a proximity item. Say, like, you know, I'm carrying metal scrap, so we're just going to break this down to so many BV of iron or so many BV of this.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever is on that chart that's close to it. It's just meant, I realize that especially in a survival game, we cannot write out a list of every possible thing you're going to come across. What we're going to try to do instead is just to template this enough that you can probably extrapolate using a little common sense out to what other items are worth. So if, you know, you pick up a handful of bolts, and we don't have a handful of bolts on there, but we do have iron on there, then you say, all right, well, it's iron, but it's machined iron, and there's no machining shops here, so maybe this iron's worth a certain amount more on top of that, and kind of just use common sense to work into it from there.
We don't want the game masters or the players sitting there for 45 minutes of their game trying to figure out the economy of one character.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of the BV system, is that it simplifies it. You can have trade, and it's real quick. I want that clip for my gun. I have 15 BV worth of stuff, and I buy the gun for 15 BV. When the game and we make that exchange. When the game master goes to describe it, he describes a barter, and there's haggling, and you know, you role play that out a little bit, and then you get the clip and you hand over the stuff.
We also have something kind of unusual in mind for how we are going to give someone their starting equipment, but I want to hold that because further down the list, we are going to do a whole show on character creation.
And
I want to save it for that. For those of you wondering what is we keep making these noises for, I'll post a link with the show notes. But
thank you.
We will get to that again when we get to character creation. So let's roll into the SOG Q&A.
Oh, I'm excited about this one because it's clever.
This one actually...
I have no clue what it even is.
Oh, it is clever. Adam had a brilliant idea. We're actually going to take a joke, and we're going to translate this into a real Q&A.
SOG Q&A, that's right, babe.
All
right,
on our forums, Quinn asked a question. He said, why is SOG not being done in the monostat system? Which, of course,
monostat isn't.
Monostat being tongue-in-cheek.
That's our joke.
The question was tongue-in-cheek. But it does bring up something, a real thing that we are doing. So, Adam, do you want to go into this since you're so excited?
Not really.
Okay. Great.
We're going to have different
You'll explain it better, and now Tim White can just accuse me of being, well, we'll just go
intimidated by me. Yeah. I muted your mic. So what we are going to do, however, as Mike just said there, is we are going to tier the rules. We have decided, because one of the things that we have seen within the role-playing community, or even at this table, is people like different complexity in the rules. There are some people who are big into storytelling where they say, look, I just want to tell a story. I don't care about the stupid rules. Paper, scissors, rock is fine with me. Let's just get on with the game.
Then nope, there's, that's me.
And then there's strong simulationists like me, and I believe John as well, and I think Adam, you too, who would love just to see mounds and mounds and mounds of information and stats and all this other stuff.
Tables and charts.
So here's what we realize, sort of a common sense thing, that in order to give the complex rules, you have already given simple rules along the way.
I agree.
Common sense sort of observation. To reach a ton, you first have to have 1 pound. So what we are going to do is, as we write the rules, we are going to give every section of rules in 3 blocks. Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3. So, for example, let's take something like combat. At the Tier 1 rules, it's going to be real simple, meant to get on with the game. It's going to be kind of compare your party to their party, shoot 2 dice or opposed dice, and based on how you roll, here's what happened. Real straightforward, something you do in 30 seconds. Tier 2 is where we get into, okay, here's initiative rolls and 2-hit rolls and the kind of combat rules people are more used to. Tier 3 is where we get into the really heavy stuff, like detailed wounds and walking machine gun fire and all the strange
grappling
stuff.
And all sorts of crazy stuff.
Crazy stuff like that. And this is something that we are going to do anywhere that we give. Well, I would say anywhere, but most
anywhere
of the places.
We can
yeah, anywhere we can reasonably do it, we are going to do this. And so this is going to make it real easy for you to kind of pick the complexity of the game you want. And then also, if at some point we end up running demos or whatever cons, it's real easy because you can just say, hey, this is going to be a Skies of Glass Tier 2 game. And everybody knows instantly what it is to expect. And it just seemed like a common sense thing we could do to give you guys some level of control over how the game plays without us having to add any more complexity to the rules than we would do anyway.
And eventually they know I'm going to run a game, and I'm going to throw all these rules out anyway. So,
well, actually, that's why we created Tier 0 for you. Tier 1, 2, and 3 are
just
the regular
rules.
Just a roll
of Charmin.
Tier 0 is monostat. You roll your stat, and there you go.
There
Every
you
time
go.
You have to roll,
and then you can
you
forget your stat and leave it in the car, because it never really mattered anyway. Which actually brings us to the Chad system, which is the null stat system.
Null stat?
I tell you, character
which
sheets
would be
are
like,
your people's crutches.
Eat a pizza. If it tastes good, you did well.
Oh, you and your rules. Jeez.
All right, well, thank you guys very much for tuning in, and we will catch you all next time.
Ooh.
This has been a production of Hear the Boot. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to HearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at HearTheBoot.com.